Good evening, friends. This is Franz Weinschenk, here to welcome you to Valley Writers Read, where tonight we're going to hear part of the life story of a really delightful person who immigrated from France to this country, where she soon became a citizen. Her name is Evelyn Olang, and she now lives in the beautiful foothill community of Korsgold, which, as you know, is not all that far from Yosemite. Evelyn entitles her story, I Am an American. And here she is, ladies and gentlemen, Evelyn Olang, reading I Am an American.
I am an American. When I was a little girl, growing up in Normandy, France, I knew one fact about the United States of America. It was the country who ended World War II. In my small town, nestled in the heart of the battlefields, I heard endless stories about the German occupation, D-Day, and the American liberators. I knew about the chewing gum, the chocolate, and the cigarettes, long-absent delights offered by the American soldiers to the people of France. My father was 10 years old at the beginning of the war, and my mother 12. They spent 4 years of their youth in a country occupied by the enemy. Their gratitude for the Americans had no limits, and they made sure that my sister and I shared it as well. The war had left many tangible imprints in Normandy: blockhouses, monuments, memorials, and cemeteries haunted my backyard. I effortlessly embraced anything coming from America with fervor and respect. I lived a few kilometers away from a medieval castle, witness of the bloody battles that tore France for centuries. Several memorials reminded me of one war or another. A couple of Catholic churches and many more cafes filled the quiet town. Time there trickled, slow and peaceful, and since I loved reading more than anything, I spent hours at the public library, housed in one aisle of the castle. The musty smell rising from the books, stacked on shelves from floor to ceiling, and the sound of the Norman rain beating against the large French windows, summed up some of my most vibrant experiences of reading. I would have spent all of my free time at the library if my sister, a social butterfly, had not been expertly persuasive. Going to town for her didn't mean checking books at the library, but boys at the cafe's terraces and clothes in the boutique windows. She would have preferred buying to window shopping, but money was tight at home and she had often to limit her dreams to lèche vitrine. Yet, the time my sister spent licking the windows for the most recent clothes sharpened her eye, and she could spot the last fashion trends better than I. One day, she noticed the opening of a new boutique selling American clothing. It would open the path to many more in the following years, but in the mid-70s, it was the only one to carry Levi's, white cotton t-shirts, and various exotic American brand items. My excitement had no limits, but my savings did. Yet, I had to get a pair of jeans and a t-shirt. My mother refused. In addition to being a homemaker, she was a skilled seamstress, a métier her grandmother had taught her as a child and that she embraced at the age of 12 when she left school forever. Besides sewing coats, blouses and skirts, wedding dresses and business suits for a faithful clientele, my mother made our own clothes. At the Catholic school I attended, girls were not allowed to wear pants, except in extremely cold weather and only underneath dresses or skirts. Yet, after school, I envied my classmates who wore jeans, t-shirts, and other popular American clothes. My mother, who never missed expressing gratitude towards Americans, seemed reluctant to let me wear jeans that she didn't find feminine. If she had welcomed the American liberation, she fought hard against the American cultural invasion and in favor of our distinctive French style. Meanwhile, I was dying to get my first pair of Levi's. My mother offered to make me a pair. She was talented, but the idea of wearing homemade jeans was certainly not what I had in mind. Finally, after months of saving, I bought my first pair of jeans. I didn't have enough money to get the white cotton t-shirt. However, I paraded around the house the entire evening in my Levi's, repeating whole sentences from my English textbook. The radio played all day long at my home. The soundtrack of my childhood was a mixture of American, British, and French music. Whenever I could afford it, I bought American records. I played them until I could copy the words down. My patience was endless when it came to learning American lyrics. Sometimes the albums included the words, and I would read them again and again, my French-English dictionary sitting next to me, until I could translate the songs I loved. I grew up in a France that walked hand in hand with America, and every teen I knew wanted to go there someday. I didn't dare dream about it. America was out of my reach. And my consolation was when La Redoute, JCPenney's French mail order catalogue, introduced a collection of sweatshirts embroidered with American logos. I begged my mother to purchase one, and I wore my navy blue sweatshirt with the white letters of UCLA through my senior year. On the morning of my baccalaureate, the mandatory French high school exit exam, I wore my sweatshirt for the PE test. The judge asked if anyone wanted to start first. Since nobody volunteered, he pointed at me. "You, Ucla, you'll be the first one." He had read the UCLA logo as if it were one word. Only years later, living in California, did I discover the true meaning of the four letters that I had displayed in my senior year. These were my only exposures to the American world. The USA presented a way of life that was foreign to me and my friends. Swimming pools in people's backyards, Hollywood stars, and wild rock bands. The USA smelled of unlimited freedom, wild oceans, and eternal youth. When France's social conscience weighed on teenagers' shoulders, America irradiated the possibility to escape the social shackles. School taught French young people about the risk of unemployment and of the necessity to make wise professional choices. The USA, on the other hand, promised endless opportunities leading to roads paved with gold. Of course, growing up in France in the late 70s between two working middle-class parents meant listening to frequent criticism toward the American capitalism. These ideals were the ones that my parents taught me, although I shared them as any teen who hasn't yet acquired own opinions. I longed for a world of wide open horizons. Before moving to the USA, I was ripe for the opportunities of a larger world, although I had no idea I would live one day for the other side of the Atlantic, even less that I would become a US citizen. I left Paris for California late 1990, following my young husband's career. The USA felt like a gigantic Disneyland when I arrived in the San Francisco Bay Area. Although I came from Paris, where the motto is to act blasé, I couldn't resist friendly California. Everything surprised me, charmed me, and made me smile. But if I was thrilled to discover the new world, I also missed the rules of the game and didn't fully understand how the Magic Kingdom worked. What better way to learn about my new home than hands-on experience? My explorations didn't come without mistakes, and I quickly understood that being a recent immigrant was a full-time job. Among many faux pas, a few episodes remain fond memories, even though they were then blushing moments. The San Francisco Bay Area in the early 90s was a village for a Parisian, and I enjoyed the daily walks I took with my baby in quiet Palo Alto. But if the streets were peaceful, I found odd that people had never met greeted me like a good old friend with, "Hi, how are you?" I wondered why they spoke to my baby. It is honest to say that the American genuine friendliness I've come to cherish and miss the most when I am in France felt at first strange and almost dangerous. Yet, after observing this cheerfulness along the streets, I deduced that it was the American way, and after a couple of weeks of such a treatment, I started to enjoy it. Who can resist a smile and a friendly, "How are you?" In the weeks following my arrival, I missed Paris' familiar sounds and smells, my busy job and my friends. I took my baby to the park twice a day, hoping to meet other young mothers. Whenever I met one, I noticed that she politely nodded as I was extending my hand as we do in France to greet new people. I always managed to retract my hand in time. Later, as I started to make friends, they pulled me toward them in the full embrace. I found hugs odd for a long time, dreading being squeezed against someone else's body. I have now adopted this custom, and when I return to France, I have a hard time giving perfect strangers kisses, even when introduced by relatives. I'm glad that at least I chose to shake hands rather than to kiss people when I first arrived in the USA. Americans conquered my heart with their smiles and welcoming gestures. But when I saw for the first time the open house sign with the colorful balloons billowing in the gentle California breeze, it triggered curiosity and shock. Opening their homes on Sundays to perfect strangers was definitely not French at all. In my native country, privacy is guarded with fences and gates. For several Sundays, I noticed the houses adorned with the sign "open." One day, I couldn't resist and entered one of them. A bowl filled with silver-wrapped candies sat next to a lovely bouquet of flowers on a table. A smiling lady welcomed me with the usual, "How are you?" I returned a welcome and she went on, rattling more words, punctuated by more smiles. Offering me a candy, she took me on a tour of the house. I was impressed, but quite confused when she handed me a business card. A quick glimpse at the name made my blood swish. I recognized the words "real estate." In a flash, I understood that the friendly lady was not the owner of the house. As I tried to find some familiar words in my limited English vocabulary to thank her for a time, a young couple, seasoned in the art of the open houses, showed up. They saved me from an embarrassing moment. I left, a little sad that the reality wasn't as sweet as it had seemed, but also relieved that I wouldn't have to open my own house on Sundays. If I thought that opening your house to strangers was generous but a little odd, my first American grocery shopping experience was a trip to heaven. When the Safeway cashier unloaded my cart, I rushed to help. He smiled and told me something that I translated into a, "Thanks, I'll manage." His badge read, "Mike, serving you since 1980. I thanked Mike, taking him for an exceptionally considerate cashier since I was accompanied by a one-year-old baby. As any French person would do in 1991, I offered him a tip. He refused with another smile. Another employee arrived and with a grin as friendly as Mike's, asked me something that I again did not understand. He repeated, and if I understood the words, The question puzzled me. Paper or plastic? I shrugged and he bagged my groceries in large brown paper bags. I peeked at his badge and rushed to help Josh. With a smile, he refused. I wondered if I should try to tip Josh, but a glance around confirmed that not a single customer was unloading his cart or bagging his groceries. Was this heaven or what? In France, cashiers only scan groceries. They sit behind their registers like queen bees in the beehives. In their classy uniforms, they guard a strange kingdom that is always short on change. French cashiers always insist for the exact amount. They also address customers with the formal monsieur or madame, and certainly don't wear a tag giving away their name. They won't ask you if you found everything all right, and won't ask for help if the line is long. You won't find restrooms in French supermarkets. Employees won't help, but will order your child to stop touching the products. Yet, I love French supermarkets. After all, they carry delicacies such as fresh oysters, foie gras, countless cheeses and dairy products, pastries, chocolates, and renowned wines that you can only find in upscale markets in the USA. Even the frozen section and its prepared meals beat many American restaurants. But where is my American smile? Paper or plastic belongs to my vocabulary now, and although I've started to shop with my own bags as the French do, I'm still in awe with the American customer service. Here, I am the queen bee and not the other way around. In my early days in the USA, phone calls were a challenge. I wrote down what I had to say to stay away from major embarrassing situations, but I didn't avoid a few gaffes. The first time I called a hair salon for a haircut, I asked for a rendezvous. I also asked for a rendezvous to a pediatrician, a dentist, and a few moms I met. The French do have rendezvous to cut their hair, to get their physicals, to have their teeth cleaned, and to organize playdates for their children. Of course, they also have rendezvous with their chéri or chérie. Even for a French woman, asking for a date to professional providers was embarrassing when I learned the correct word was appointment. Although I could read English with the help of a dictionary, pronunciation tricked me on a regular basis. Once, in a small country store, I met the clerk's polite but blank face. Puzzled by my request, she handed me a pen and paper. "Ah," she exclaimed after she read, "you want baby diapers." No better way to learn a foreign language than mimicking the natives. Since that day, I never again mispronounced diapers and, by extension, diaries and diagrams, diamonds and diabetes, diagnosis and dialogues. Yet, it took me a while to make the distinction between a windy road and a windy day, between vine and vineyard. But someone has to admit that these pronunciation tricks are cruel to the non-native. Shopping trips delighted me, even though they were often the source of misunderstanding. Once, I was looking for a hair dryer advertised in a long drugs flyer. The young salesman went on a friendly explanation in which I caught several times the words rain and check. A glance through the window confirmed that the sky was still blue, and I had no desire to write a check for something I couldn't purchase. I kept saying no each time the words rain and check came up. The salesman was patient, but finally gave up. I don't blame him if he thought I was dumb. I just had no clue what a rain check was, that's all. When my little girl started a weekly playgroup, one of the moms told me that the only problem with this class was the absence of makeup days. I thought the idea to apply makeup on children barely older than babies was strange. Of course, the children had dress-up days and cooking days, but it's only when they had face-painting days that I exclaimed, "Oh, but they have makeup day." The mom smiled and said, "Of course they do. Why wouldn't they?" With the rent check and the makeup days, I learned that expressions vary from one country to another, and that's how I quit having the hand bumps for the goose bumps. The post office became a second home since I kept my family informed on my life in the US. One morning, as I was waiting in line, a man tapped my shoulder. "Hey," he said, "are you from Brookline?" I recognized the name of Brookline and wondered how in the world he could think I was from New York City. Watching my puzzled face, the man smiled and pointed to my jacket. When I left for California, my sister offered me a baseball jacket as an early Christmas gift. I love the huge logo on the back. As it had been for my UCLA sweatshirt, I had no clue what it meant, but it was American, wasn't it? The man went on, explaining he was from Brookline himself. "And I don't know this team," he added, perplexed, "even though I'm a baseball fan." I certainly was not a baseball pro, and I smiled an apologetic smile. "No, I'm not from Brookline," I said. He laughed. "No, for sure, you are not. Where are you from?" "From France." The mention of France lit his face, and I managed to explain that maybe my jacket, made in China and sold in France, was not promoting a real American baseball team. "That explains it," the man said with another laugh. When I left the post office, he gave me the thumbs up and said, "Go, Brookline." I treasure these memories of my first months in America. The people I met appreciated my effort to speak their language, and I enjoyed their enthusiasm when they also practiced their rusty French. We were sharing the fun of discovering our different roots, and I still cherish these blushing moments. The visits of our families helped ease my transition between France and the USA, and I especially enjoyed my father-in-law's enthusiasm to embrace our new American lifestyle. He had been a French teacher, and in France, a pile of dictionaries sat like soldiers on top of his desk. Our move to the USA was the perfect occasion to learn new words and purchase a new French-American dictionary. Faithful to his desire to improve his English, he took every opportunity to practice. His hours of study were paying off. Yet, one day, I knew something had challenged him. "I went to the bakery," he said. "I read the board before ordering my coffee, and I was sure of my choice," he went on. "But the young lady kept asking me something, and I couldn't understand, so I kept repeating, 'One espresso, please.'" He shrugged, and I shared his frustration. How embarrassing to seem stupid or deaf or both when people keep asking you the same question. "She was really nice," my father-in-law insisted. "I just wonder what she asked me." He looked at me expectantly. After all, I was the one living here. I should have known. But my boundaries then were the playground, the pediatrician, the grocery store, and the library. "I'm sorry," I said. "Was the coffee good?" "Oh, yes," my father-in-law said. "Just don't understand why she put it in a paper cup. Une tasse would have been nicer." "I know," I exclaimed. I had a clear vision of my father-in-law expecting a porcelain cup when he got a paper cup, only used then for picnics in France. "She asked you for here or to go?" I said with a smile. He looked at me, bunching his eyebrows together. "I don't understand." "Here, you see, you can have your coffee in the cafe or you can take it with you." "Why would I do that? Where would I go with my coffee?" "To go," I explained, "is for people who don't have time to sit to drink their coffee." "If I don't have time," he said, "I just don't have a coffee." As he cupped his chin perplexed, I wondered if he thought that the land of opportunities wasn't that perfect after all. If you couldn't sit down to enjoy a cup of coffee in a real cup and had to rush somewhere with a paper cup, then what mattered? It took me many years before ordering my first coffee to go and many more to switch from espresso to latte. But I've never yet ordered a coffee through the drive-thru lane. 10 years and 3 American-born children later, I decided to become a U.S. citizen. I was interviewed for my naturalization on my youngest child's third birthday. It was also Patriot Day in Massachusetts, and I believed it could only bring me good luck. I waited in a room packed with dozens of anxious-looking people. Every single language spoken on Earth was represented in this typical administrative waiting room that smelled of hairspray, of aftershave, and of fear, too. Although I felt more alien than ever, I relaxed, listening to the broken English around me. If they accepted us upon our English knowledge, I had an advantage. But then I observed the men and women coming from every possible South American, Asian, or Eastern Europe country. We shared a common dream, each of us wearing the tag of our origin as if the USA needed more proof that they were still the land of dreams for so many. When my turn came, I was asked to give the name of the governor of my state, to recite an amendment, and to write down the date and my name. I expected more questions, but the employee stamped some papers and gave me the date of the oath ceremony. I was relieved, but also disappointed. I had worked hard at memorizing the booklet for the interview. For a few months, I'm sure I knew more about U.S. history and contemporary politics than any U.S.-born individual. A few weeks went by before the big day. I was anxious and impatient, but some sadness washed over me. Was I ready to give up my French citizenship? After all, it was not as though France was a dangerous and safe and healthy country I had to flee. I thought of my parents. They had been surprised and maybe even hurt when I told them that I was considering getting a U.S. citizenship. Doesn't it make sense, I told them? We work here, we pay our taxes here. Three of our children were born here. I want to be part of the country's life. I want to vote. I even want to be on jury duty. I realized I was talking to myself. Did I need to convince me? I had every reason to become an American citizen. That was clear to me. I guess it was not so clear to my family. France doesn't consider some of its darker-skinned immigrants really French, even when they are born on French ground. Their lack of enthusiasm shattered my conviction. Were my parents concerned that no matter what, I would never truly be an American? Did they believe that no matter what, I would still be French? Or worse, did they suspect I would never be either one? Some kind of part-time French, part-time American? The day I became an American citizen, my husband and children accompanied me, but the packed hallways leading to the oath room convinced them to wait outside. I was too nervous to object. I was expecting an emotional crowd, but I suppose that waiting in line had worn off some of the emotion. Some people complained as the line snaked along the hallway. Finally, we entered the large room. It was too noisy and crowded to notice anything, except the American flag, which made my heart flutter. When the judge asked us to repeat the oath after her, most people muttered incoherent words. My neighbor spoke through his teeth. Many around me didn't seem to speak English at all. I did my best to cover for them. When we all raised our hands and swore fidelity to our new country, silence made its way through the room. Faces of all kinds, all colors, and all ages surrounded me, and amidst this sea of foreign people, I swallowed the tight small ball stuck in my throat. I thought again of my parents, proud French citizens, and I knew that somehow the idea of their daughter becoming an American citizen was upsetting them. Yet, a powerful wave washed over me. I was not an alien anymore. I would not carry my green card anymore. I would vote. I was part of the perpetual history of U.S. immigration. I had told my children that after the ceremony, I would be a U.S. citizen, like them. My daughter inspected me thoroughly. suspect she was a little bit disappointed when I emerged from the room. After all, I still looked the same. Her sister liked Coca-Cola and ketchup, which I only bought for special occasions. She was thrilled that finally a mother would be normal. Alas, her excitement fell when I told her that we would still eat fresh vegetables and fruit and that I would still say no to after-dinner snacks. Her consolation prize was that I promised I'd never stop making crepes and baking madeleine. I knew that much more than food would make me a U.S. citizen. I didn't know yet that I would find out soon the true meaning of being one. A year later, on September 11, 2001, the phone woke me up at 6 a.m. My husband was on the line, calling from Boston. "There was an attack against the U.S., he said, his voice catching in his throat. "In New York City, it's awful. Many people have already died." My husband was supposed to fly home on September 11, on board of one of the planes that left Boston early that morning but never made it to California. He had accepted a last-minute invitation for dinner for that very same day and postponed his flight. I hung up and, as mechanic as a robot, opened the French door onto the patio. An insolent Indian summer morning welcomed me. The street slept under a cloudless California sky. I thought of our children who almost lost their dad and of the children who became orphans this morning. Unable to grasp the shock that was already changing every American life, I hoisted the flag, a gift to my husband when he became American citizen. The following day, the headline of the French newspaper Le Monde read, "Nous sommes tous Américains," or "We are all Americans." I had never felt more American than that day. Over the following years, although flying has become less pleasant, I have visited France many times. Everything should be familiar, but I observe the country I was born in, the people who speak my mother language, with the same curiosity I had observed the USA when I arrived, wondering if in France another era passes while I'm away. France states of familiar customs, but America has become home. Yet as much as I long for California's sun while I am in France, Paris rain tugs at my heart while I am in America, leaving me torn between my native home and the home I made from scratch. "You would be the American woman who was born in France," my husband tells me each time I am tempted to stay in France. "That would be terrible." He's right, of course, and it makes me laugh. I became l'American as soon as I left France. I don't remind him that I am the French woman in America, even years after becoming a citizen. While my native country is challenged with immigration issues and questions its national identity, the latest American census will provide numbers and information helping us to know more about the people who make today's America. As for me, I've come up with my own definition of my identity. I am from Normandy's green pastures, coastal windy beaches, quaint stone villages, and centuries-old churches. I am from rainless California summers, blustery northeastern storms, gated communities, and mile-long malls. I am from meatless Fridays, Catholic schools, third-day catechism, Sunday mass, prayers for forgiveness, and penitence after confess. I am from the Pledge of Allegiance, junior and senior proms, youth groups, second chances, and redemption for all. I am from veal stew, quiche Lorraine and crème brûlée, baguette café au lait, and after-dinner calvados. I am from macaroni and cheese, corn on the cob and barbecue, cereal and milk, and sun-steeped California wines. I am from Edith Piaf, Julien Clerc, Renaud, Françoise Hardy, the French rock and rap, and the accordion. I am from Janis Joplin, Bruce Springsteen, Pat Benatar, Madonna, the American jazz and blues, and the guitar. I am from smoky Parisian cafes, fragrant African markets, tourist Champs-Élysées, intimate leather booths, blood-drenched beaches, and hard farm benches. I am from fried food joints, ethnic Little Italy and Chinatown, Hollywood Walk of Fame, rowdy cocktail bars, desolate Ground Zero, and creaking rocking chairs. I am from Guy de Maupassant, Baudelaire, Émile Zola, Victor Hugo, Albert Camus, and Philippe Labro. I am from John Steinbeck, Ernest Hemingway, Ray Bradbury, William Styron, Joyce Carol Oates, and Stephen King. I am from barbarian invasions, proud French resistance, shameful Vichy collaboration, social conscience, and conservative colonists. I am from Indian devastation, appalling slavery, bloody civil war, the shot heard around the world, the gold rush, and woman liberation. I am from men who go on strike, vote to the left, smoke Gauloise, and drink Bordeaux. I am from men who die for world freedom, walk on the moon, wear jeans to work, and drink Budweiser. I am from women who go to the market, cook every day, give to the poor, and gossip after church. I am from women who shop online, freeze meals for the week, volunteer at school, and have girlfriends' nights. I am from all past and young history. I am an American.
And we here in America and California, in the Central Valley, on Valley Public Radio, and especially on Valley Writers Read, welcome you, Evelyn O'Lang, into our midst. You've already proved that you're a delightful, responsible, and contributing American citizen, and of course, we wish you and your family all the very best. Yes, friends, that was Evelyn O'Lang reading her memoir about her own life, all about her experiences in becoming an American citizen. We enjoyed all those anecdotes that show some of the different lifestyles of two cultures. For example, we learned that Americans tend to be rather casual, while their French counterparts are inclined to be quite formal. After listening to Evelyn, we can appreciate how a person new to a language can really get mixed up. For example, it's got to be confusing to a person just learning English when somebody in a store tells you you'll be getting a rain check, or what to say when the waitress asks you, that coffee you ordered, is that for here or to go? Or when your women friends tell you they're going to put on their makeup, or when somebody tells you they have goosebumps, or exactly how to answer a grocery clerk when she asks you, paper or plastic? Thanks, Evelyn. Your story tonight was amusing, enlightening, and especially at the close, really touching. Friends, Evelyn O'Lang won first place in the Foster City Writing Contest. She's had essays published in the French daily newspaper, Le Monde, in Spider magazine, and has written two novels for young adults. We thank her for her delightful story tonight and hope she'll have another one for us for next year. And so we come to the end of another edition of Valley Writers Read. Thank you for listening. If you'd like to listen to tonight's or any other Valley Writers Read story again, just go online to kvpr.org and link up with archived audio. Next week, our writer reader will be Jim Ashford. In the meantime, this is your host, Franz Weinschenk, wishing you and yours a great life story until we meet again. Good night.
Valley Writers Read is a production of Valley Public Radio, produced by Don Weaver and Franz Weinschenk. Please join us again next Wednesday at 7 p.m. for another edition of Valley Writers Read.